The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. How's everybody doing? It's still unseasonably warm around here at the moment, which kind of gives me the impression, and it's not necessarily a mistaken impression, that we're living in a very slow and badly plotted science fiction movie. The climate's changing, and because it's happening so subtly, people aren't really paying attention except to mention it in podcasts. So, it's genuinely freaky, and it's increasingly disturbing how unsettlingly warm May is and has been here in Melbourne. For instance, we went down to the coast yesterday, and it was quite warm. It was comfortably warm. I just had a kind of light jacket on. But, normally you get a cold, biting wind, and people are rugged up with beanies and scarves and all that sort of thing when they hit seaside seafood restaurants, which we did. But not in this case. In this case, it's still quite balmy, and that's kind of very, very freaky. I did overindulge in the seafood, by the way. When you go to a seafood restaurant, and on the menu is a seafood platter for one, my best advice to you is kind of avoid it, because there's a shit ton of really yummy seafood there. I have prawns, crab, calamari, fish, scallops, baked, kind of crumbed and deep-fried scallops, and or oysters as well, and then you get the salad and you get the fish and chips as well. So I overindulged and I went into a seafood coma when I got home from being down in the coast, and my tummy got upset. So totally self-indulgent, but there's a life lesson there, and the life lesson being don't hit a seafood platter for one, particularly if you're down at Lawn Pier, even though it is quite good food, and the company was excellent as well. We had a couple of friends we met down there, and had a very nice day of it, and I found a whole bunch of the English editions of 1950 science fiction pulp magazine. So, that day was not a total write-off, in spite of the fact that my digestive tract was. So, what have I been watching? I've been following a long-running series, which is probably going to run about 8 weeks, which is all about hatred and vindictiveness and nastiness and ambition and aspiration and things like that, and it's called the federal election. So I've been watching a lot of news and political coverage of the Australian federal election. It's knocked Donald Trump off the front page, which is something for which I am eternally grateful. It's been one of the more nasty political campaigns that I can recall. There's a viciousness about it which is kind of problematic for me, and that kind of nastiness really does get me down a little bit. I think that you can kind of go out to get the votes of a populace without smashing the head of your opponent to a pulp in the arena of politics and in the arena of ideas, which is why I like to see more women in politics, apart from the fact that it's an equity issue and it should happen anyway. I think that there's testosterone does not bring out the best in people when it's manifested on a national stage. And there's a way too much pissing competition going on in politics, in this country at least, for my comfort. So I then took refuge in my usual thing in which to take refuge, which is cinema. Well, not cinema, but movies. So I watched the first, all three Iron Man movies, because I'm going to be doing a panel, I think I am anyway, at Continuum next month about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it seemed an idea to sit back and refresh myself on the first three Iron Man movies. There may be a fourth one, we're still not sure. And rewatching them, I realised that Tony Stark is a pretty fucked up human being in a lot of ways. He was an arrogant prick who kind of had his comeuppance when he was captured by terrorists. he redeemed himself somewhat. He got PTSD. He started and fucked up a relationship with Pepper Potts. And in general, he's a kind of incredibly flawed person to make as a hero in a movie series. Nonetheless, it works. Particularly the third one with Shane Black, because Shane Black and Robert Downey Jr. have that kind of rapport where Robert Downey Jr. is a very, very good person to kind of do Shane Black dialogue, as movies like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang have shown us. So, yeah, just watching the arc of Tony Stark's glitch is an interesting thing, watching them back-to-back and then kind of in the absence of the other movies, where the ensemble cast of the Avengers movies and other movies that Stark as a character has been in. Just watching that kind of three-film arc shows us just how flawed and dangerous a person Tony Stark is, which is kind of interesting, and it's going to be an approach I'm going to take when I talk about it on the panel. Shh, don't tell anyone. I did see this kind of low-budget movie I was going to talk about on the podcast, but I won't because it's ultimately fairly dull. A movie called The Day Mars Invaded Earth, and it's basically about a guy who's just landed a first Mars probe, and that Mars probe, the radio signal from the Mars probe, has brought back energy beings who can manifest as doppelgangers of human beings. The whole film pretty much takes place on one big estate on the edge of Los Angeles, and there's a lot of time spent with the characters walking through garden, looking for each other, pretty much. It's kind of, you know, there's an interesting concept there for maybe a Twilight Zone episode, and there's a nice image that the movie finishes on, which I kind of liked. It stars a guy called Kent Taylor, who's a forgotten actor from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and who ended up making low-budget science fiction movies in the 60s. He does have one significant claim to fame, because when Simon and Schuster were creating the character of Superman, they based him on two actors they'd seen in the cinema. The first one was Clark Gable, hence Clark Kent, and the second one was Kent Taylor, hence the Kent part of Clark Kent. So Kent Taylor is the man on whom Clark Kent was named, partly along with Clark Gable. But the movie's in black and white. It's actually a black and white cinemascope, which is unusual for a fairly low budget film. And the acting is kind of not much better than it needs to be. But, you know, if you're a completist with this kind of 1950s science fiction cinema, it may be worth checking out. It's not hard to find out there. I'm not sure whether it's quite in the public domain or just widely available. But one way or the other, The Day Mars Invaded Earth is, you know, for completists, in a sense. So the other thing I really enjoyed watching, I've got a thing for those Columbia rock and roll movies from the 1950s when rock and roll was first coming out, where they put a pretty thin plot and then just do kind of acts on stage. This one's called Let's Rock, and it stars Julius LaRose, a singer who died only a few days ago, and his claim to fame was that he was the featured singer on Arthur Godfrey's television show back in the 1950s, in about 1952, 1953. Started out in the Navy and then became a singer, and he was very popular. And he got sacked on the air because Arthur Godfrey didn't want the people working on his TV show to have agents. He wanted to deal with them directly, of course, because there's a financial advantage in doing that. But Julius LaRose did outside gigs and got an agent. And Arthur Godfrey got so pissed off, he sacked him on stage, pretty much on live television. Julius LaRose's career went on for a long time. He became a DJ in New York City, and right up till nearly his death, did a radio show about jazz music for a radio station in New York. So Julius LaRose is in Let's Rock. It's actually quite a cool film. There's an actress who plays the love interest to Julius LaRose's character, and her name is Phyllis Newman. She's very good in it, too. They got a nice rapport. She started out doing musicals on Broadway stage and went on to have a long career as an actor. So she's in it. Paul Anka, very, very, very young Paul Anka, is in there playing himself and doing a little bit. Della Reese does an act. The Royal Teens do their one hit, Short Shorts. The Tyrones do a really groovy song as well. It's a kind of, well, no better or worse than any of the other 1950s Columbia rock and roll movies. It does have Danny and the Juniors doing the at the Hop, which is kind of nice to watch as well, because that one, I think that's the only bit of decent film of them doing that. And it kind of does, the story's not too bad either. It's about the singer played by Julius LaRosa. He's a crooner, and rock and roll comes in, and crooners are starting to die out as popular music stars, and he's got to kind of navigate his way from being very successful to being not so successful, because he doesn't want to do rock and roll music. He doesn't think he can do it honestly. He doesn't think he's got the passion for it. And there's a nice character arc there where he kind of comes to terms with what he can do and what he can't do and how he can do it. Excuse me. Which is kind of a little bit better than most of these things are. I really should do a podcast about covering those Night Columbia rock and roll movies from the 1950s. They're all black and white. They're all kind of groovy and of their time, but they do feature some acts that there's really not much other footage of, which is kind of nice from an historical point of view. So I watched that. Let me have a look here, see what else I've got on there. I did rewatch Terminator Genisys, and it wasn't any good. Same as the first time I watched it. It was on cables, and I was too lazy to reach for the remote control, pretty much. And yeah, Terminator Genisys, the stars aren't charismatic enough to carry it, and you really do need charismatic stars. Arnold Schwarzenegger playing old Arnie with a CG Arnold Schwarzenegger playing young Terminator Arnie. It doesn't really work. Jai Courtney and Emilia Clarke just don't have, I don't know whether it's the talent or whether it's the script to really carry it as well as they should, you know, the character should have. But and also the plot's all over the fucking place. But that's pretty much all I've been watching lately. I have watched a little bit of television. I watched Legends of Tomorrow, which is kind of a vulgar pleasure of mine, because it's interesting to see how they try to correct the casting errors they make during the series, and how some of the more minor characters actually shine on things. But nonetheless, it's popcorn television in that sense, and I kind of enjoy that as well. I am also watching the final and fifth season of Person of Interest, the most underrated science fiction TV show on at the moment. It's getting to a really interesting stage with a fight between two AIs fought on the streets of New York through human intermediaries, and that makes things really cool for me. And there's some really nice ways of telling the story in different ways. I mean, it's a format that could get very stale unless you kind of find a new way to tell the story. And the interesting thing about season 5 of Person of Interest is that they manage it. They do have at least two episodes where things are framed and the story is told in such a way that it kind of blindsides the audience about certain things, and that's very, very cool for me, particularly with the audience for this kind of a TV series is very sophisticated, and having the makers of the TV series still manage to throw a blind twist into the plot, it's pretty good going. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies, which is Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, starring Allison Hayes and Yvette Vickers.
Once a normal, voluptuously beautiful woman, she drove into a nightmare of horror and saw descending from the sky a titanic monster whose fearsome touch became a frightful curse.
You think I'm drunk, don't you? All of you! I'm not drunk! I'm not! You've got to believe me!
Please.
It was right in the middle of the highway, 30 feet tall!
Munchies in the booby hatch? Throw the key away. That'll put you in the driver's seat. You'd make a wild driver, Harry. With $50 million.
What she saw was beyond belief until others, too, faced its hideous, uncontrollable menace. Attack of the 50-foot woman, incredibly huge, with incredible desires for love and vengeance.
Okay, so Attack of the 50-Foot Woman is an American 1958 movie. It's widely considered to be a really, really bad film, but I find it kind of interesting. And it was made on an $89,000 budget, came in about 10 grand under budget. And it's fairly short, too. It's only like about 65 minutes. It stars Alison Hayes, William Hudson, and Yvette Vickers. And the story is pretty simple. When an abused socialite grows to giant size because of an alien encounter and an aborted murder attempt, she goes after her cheating husband with revenge in mind. That pretty much covers it. But there's something about this film that people really like. The poster for the film is widely considered to be one of the coolest and best movie posters of all time. And it's been reproduced any number of times in any number of ways as well. It's that usual one with the kind of giant woman wearing a bedsheet bikini, straddling a highway overpass, carrying a cop car in one hand and reaching down towards some scrambling people and crashed cars in the other. It's kind of, you know, basically, it's a very powerful female image in a way, the poster for that movie. The poster was actually designed by Roger Corman, and Roger Corman had his finger on the pulse of popular culture cinema at the time. Yeah, it is a very, very strong image and very cool as well. The movie was directed by a guy called Nathan Duran, who has the dubious honour, a year before he made this film, of making a movie which had wide-ranging repercussions politically throughout the world. And that is the 1957 war drama Hellcats of the Navy, starring Ronald and Nancy Reagan. Nathan Duran directed that one, which is kind of something he may well in later years have regretted. But nonetheless, he had a very long career. He made a couple of interesting genre films. Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jack the Giant Killer, First Men in the Moon, The Brain from Planet Aris, 20 Million Miles to Earth, The Deadly Mantis. Did a lot of episodic TV as well, as a lot of these directors did. Jack Arnold, for instance, in spite of his great movies that he did for Universal in the 1950s. Ended up spending the rest of his career making episodic television. But nonetheless, the direction isn't brilliantly wonderful. But Nathan Duran did start out as an art director, so he had a pretty good eye for this. And I think that's where the strength in this movie comes in. There's a few iconic images and some little bits and pieces that show, had there been a bit more money to throw around. The special effects are incredibly bad, by the way. They use superimposition, and when the giant alien comes forward in one scene, you can see through it to the background, that kind of thing. The sets they have for Alison Hayes when she becomes the giantess are kind of very dubious, but nonetheless, you kind of got to roll with that stuff in this kind of film. The character she plays is Nancy Fowler Archer, a millionaireess, whose very, very dodgy and sleazy husband, Harry, is played by a very, very B actor called William Hudson, who's got a very typical 1950s look and chain smokes and does all those things we expect from 1950s things. And he's also pretty fucking stupid. Now, the reason he's pretty fucking stupid is he makes no bones about the fact that he's going down to a local roadhouse while his wife's at home and canoodling with Honey Parker, played by Yvette Vickers, who was actually in a Playboy playmate in 1959. Yvette Vickers I'll talk about more later, but Harry basically spends his time there, and when the cops are sent by his wife, and yeah, this is a small town, his wife's a very rich person, he kind of pays them to say that he isn't there so he can continue osculating with the very comely Honey Parker. Now, this is pretty bloody stupid if you ask me, because, you know, you're setting yourself up for a very stupid divorce there. You're married to a rich woman who's attractive, and then you kind of go very openly hanging out with an obvious gold digger. It doesn't show that you've got a hell of a lot of self-knowledge and you really don't know what's in your best interest. But leaving aside how stupid Harry is, the interesting thing for me and from my lens about Nancy, the character played by Alison Hayes, is she obviously suffers from some kind of anxiety disorder, which kind of, looking at it from a 21st century viewpoint, it makes this movie slightly more interesting and very, very different. She's self-medicated in the past with alcohol. She's got an anxiety disorder. She's in need of some help, which is kind of readily available to people who have money in America in the 21st century, but perhaps less so in the 20th century. And that makes things interesting because ultimately this movie is about a woman with an anxiety disorder and issues and an asshole husband who not only seems to be getting gaslighted by her asshole husband, but is later on attacked by a giant alien that comes out of an enormous sphere and scratches her, and slowly over time she grows to, well, not 50 foot, even though it does say Attack of the 50 foot woman. From what I can figure out, she's maybe 30 foot tall. The size of her after her transformation does vary a bit in the movie, but that's the kind of movie it is. It's an $89,000 budget movie made in 1958. They're not going to get all of the perspective right. And Alison Hayes is very good in the film too, which is one of the things, like, most of her job is to scream a lot, which is kind of the thing that they had women do in these kind of movies way, way too often in the 1950s. But in spite of that, when she actually has, she has two encounters with the alien spaceship. When she has the first one, which is kind of more a passing kind of thing, she sees the alien reaches for her, and she gets away and runs back to town, leaving her car in a ditch. At the time she gets back into town, she encounters the sheriff and other people, and Alison Hayes acting in that is very good. She plays an incredibly distraught woman very well in the movie, and nobody believes her. They think she's just been on the piss again, even though she's kind of off the grog. And they kind of, you know, she's not believed by the authorities when something extraordinary happens. And we kind of feel for her in that. She has gone through something, you know, unprecedented. And yet the people around her don't believe her because of her past history. And that's something that a lot of us can identify with. Who we were in the past is not who we are in the present. And that makes Nancy a very kind of sympathetic character in some ways. Even though she's off screen for a large chunk of the movie while various other characters come into the thing, including a very dodgy doctor who says some incredibly sexist things about male and female relationships, which I'll leave you to find for yourself in there because I'm not going to repeat them. This movie seen through the lens of how women were perceived in the 1950s is a very interesting film for that reason. It really does trigger a lot of current debates in a way. Yvette Vickers' character, Honey, is kind of interesting in her own way. Yvette Vickers is very good playing the role too. I mean, the female actors are actually slightly better than the male actors in this one. And her kind of money-grubbing Honey, she plays really well. There's a kind of sexy dance that she does in the movie, which is quite pleasing to the male gaze, let's say. And she does kind of give us a little bit of background about her character, how she's poor and doesn't want to be poor and doesn't particularly have the tenacity to try to find a way out of it except through men, which again is part of the 1950s thing. Women's opportunities were a lot less in those days to go into any kind of meaningful career. So a lot of this film is, from a feminist viewpoint, about women and the way they're kind of positioned in society, which kind of makes it, it does make it very cool in that sense. But to get back to looking at it from the old viewpoint, it's very much a B drive-in movie. And there's a bit where the sheriff and somebody else go into the alien spaceship. And the alien spaceship is basically a whole bunch of glass spheres and perforated boards backlit to make them look creepy, and they probably have about three or four of those boards on set, and they reposition them scene to scene so it looks like a much larger place than it is. And there's, you know, kind of fog machines used to obscure the cheesiness of the sets, but nonetheless it kind of, even though you're aware of how cheesy the sets are, I've got to kind of admire Nathan Duran's ability to try to make them more than they are by repositioning the camera and having the perspective changed and using the glass spheres to make things kind of slightly funny and also slightly weird. The reason the alien, in fact, grabs after Nancy in the movie is because she has a large diamond she's wearing because she's a very wealthy woman. And for some reason, the alien needs the diamond to power their spaceship. Who knows why? Because a carbon-powered spaceship is, well, it's basically a steam train, isn't it? That's the only kind of vehicles we know that are powered by carbon. But having said that, the movie is I mean, I like the jukebox in the movie. That's one of the things. I've got this thing that I do when I'm watching old movies. I kind of look at the jukeboxes and go, shit, that's a cool jukebox. I wish I had that. And this movie's got a kind of nice 1950s jukebox. I think any movie's improved by having a jukebox in it. I don't care what kind of movie it is, with the possible exception of something like The Accused. That rape drama with Jodie Foster, and I don't think that was improved at all by having the jukebox in it. But as a general rule for movies that aren't particularly dramatic and particularly important, having a jukebox and having somebody put a coin in there, punch some numbers, and then start dancing, it always improves a movie for me. It's really kind of cool. I've never seen it happen in real life. I've never seen somebody put money in a jukebox and then start dancing to it. I've seen them put money in a jukebox, sit down and order a hamburger, but never actually get up and kind of do the Froog or the Pony after putting money in a jukebox in a cafe. But, yeah, you know, I suppose it happens. The other thing is that the things don't particularly end well for any of the characters in this movie. There's not really, and, you know, that pisses me off too, because, to be honest with you, watching the movie and understanding the kind of anxiety stuff that the character of Nancy's going through, I wanted her to kind of survive. I wanted her to be okay. I wanted her to kind of shrink back down to normal size without stretch marks and move on with her life after her asshole husband has some kind of unfortunate accident. But it doesn't end like that, because it's a 1950s movies, and, you know, they didn't do the right thing by women in 1950s movies, except unless they were chick flicks. But both female actors, main female actors in this movie, had unfortunate ends, which is one of those things that I'm going to mention because the trivia part's always a part of what I do here. And Alison Hayes was on a carbon supplement for a long time in the 1950s and early 1960s. And then for some reason her health began to deteriorate. She had to walk with a walking stick and was in immense amounts of pain and had all sorts of issues and died prematurely because of it. Now, it was only towards the end of her life that she had an analysis done on these calcium pills she was taking as calcium supplements, and found out they had high lead content. And she suffered for a decade or more with lead poisoning. And she also ended up lobbying the FDA to get the standards changed for these kind of health supplements. I mentioned this before in an earlier podcast, I realise, but I find it still pretty interesting. Now, Yvette Vickers went on to have not a stellar career. She had an on-off relationship with Jim Hutton, the actor, for about 15 years. And she died in the 2000s in a kind of unfortunate way. She had a heart attack and her body wasn't found for over a year in her house, which is kind of tragic and very icky as well. But she married a couple of times and had some relationships and had a nice little cottage up in the hills in Hollywood, but unfortunately had a heart attack and died and wasn't found for a while. It's very sad and quite horrible, and not the way I want to drop off the twig myself, but these things happen and they kind of remind us to us that if we have neighbours who live by themselves and we like them, check in on them now and then and just make sure that they're okay. And if they're not, get them help as quickly as possible. It's always good to have somebody who gives a damn. And from the appearances of things, Yvette Vickers didn't have that at the end of her life, which is quite sad and quite unfair. But then we know life doesn't do fair. It just does a bit fairer than death does. But that's pretty much it for Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. Of course, it was remade in 1993 with Daryl Hannah, but I think the original is much less forgettable than the 1993 one, which I will go back and rewatch at some stage. But, I think another remake may well be could be a really cool thing if it was done correctly as well, because there are some themes in that movie that really have remained unexplored in a meaningful way. And I think that now is the decade when we kind of probably should start exploring them. And I think that this movie and the plot of this movie could well be a way to do that. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about a totally different film, the 1961 Hammer werewolf movie, the only werewolf movie that Hammer did, Curse of the Werewolf, starring the redoubtable Oliver Reed.
Of Mars that had stolen the glee. each lover's heart. And so each night by the Red Sea of Mars that has stolen the gleam from a river of stars.
That was Miss Toni Fisher with The Red Sea of Mars, written by her manager, Wayne Shanklin, who also wrote her other hit, West of the Wall and The Big Hurt. I've got this as an earworm, and I played it repeatedly all last week. I kind of like it. It's a kind of 1950s science fiction-y feeling, weird and wonderful kind of tune that I really kind of like. Anyway, let's move on to Harry Ollie Reed.
It came from a land of brutality and evil. It came from terror and fear. The curse of the werewolf that was laid on a baby who grew into a man possessed by a monster. To this Spanish town, the night brought drinking and dancing, music and girls, and the moon. The full moon that turned an innocent man into a savage beast. The curse of the werewolf. A man possessed by a frenzied lust to kill and kill and kill. The curse of the werewolf. A man possessed by a desperate need for love, who found in Christina all the passionate sincerity of youth.
Christina, do you love me? Will you marry me, Christina?
You say you love me, will you marry me?
Yes. Yes, I will.
Curse of the Werewolf is a Hammer film from 1961, directed by Terence Fisher, who directed a lot of the best early Hammer films, including The Horror of Dracula, The Revenge of Frankenstein, The Mummy, The Man of Gucci, Death, The Hound of the Baskervilles, Stranglers of Bombay, Brides of Dracula, Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, Sword of Sherwood Forest, Phantom of the Opera, The Gorgon, and Dracula, Prince of Darkness. Frankenstein created Woman, The Devil Rides Out, any number of them. He was the go-to director for Hammer horror films. Now, the movie is based on a novel by Guy Endor called The Werewolf of Paris, which was set during the 1860s French Revolution then. Well, Endor's an interesting guy, too, because he was an unashamed communist. And even though the movie of Curse of the Werewolf varies drastically in a lot of ways from The Werewolf of Paris, there's still kind of, you know, intimations of class in this movie that make it quite interesting. The plot of the movie, rather than the book, which I'm not going to try to plot, even though I do have a copy of it. The story's set in 18th century Spain for some reason. They moved it from France to Spain. I think it was because they were Hammer was planning to do a movie about the Spanish Inquisition that fell through, and so they had a lot of the stuff ready for it, and so when Curse of the Werewolf came up, they moved the location for that reason. As I said, it's set in 18th century Spain. I'm going to read from the Wikipedia because it's pretty good. A beggar is imprisoned by a cruel marquis after making inappropriate remarks at the nobleman's wedding. The beggar is forgotten and survives another 15 years. His sole human contact is with the jailer and his beautiful mute daughter, played by Yvonne Romain. The aging, decrepit marquis makes advances to the jailer's daughter when she's cleaning his room. When she refuses him, the marquis throws her into the dungeon with the beggar. The beggar, driven mad by his long confinement, rapes her and then dies. The girl is released the next day and sent to entertain the marquis. She kills the old man and flees. She's found in the forest by the kindly gentleman scholar Don Alfredo Corlido, played by Clifford Evans, who lives alone with his housekeeper Teresa. The woman, motherly Teresa, soon nurses the girl back to health, but she dies after giving birth to a baby on Christmas Day. Alfredo and Teresa raise the boy, whom they name Leon. Leon is cursed by the evil circumstances of conception and by his Christmas Day birthday. An early hunting incident gives him a taste for blood, which he struggles to overcome. Soon, a number of goats are found dead, and the herder's dog is blamed. 13 years later, Leon, as a young man, Oliver Reed, leaves home to seek work at the Gomez Vineyard. Don Fernando Gomez, played by a New Zealand actor called Ewan Solon, sets Leon to work in the wine cellar with Jose, with whom he soon forms a friendship. Leon falls in love with Fernando's daughter, Christina, played by Catherine Feller, and becomes despondent at the seeming impossibility of marrying her. This then triggers the lycanthropy to come back again, and everything falls into a fucking screaming heap. That's pretty much it. Now, there's a few... We've got to kind of unwrap that a little bit. The interesting thing is the beggar goes to the Marquesa's palace to beg for food. He's starving. So what they do is they ply him with wine. He gets really drunk and acts silly and is just trying to get a feed. Now, the guy who plays the beggar is a very interesting character actor who has a good history in horror films. And that's Richard Wordsworth, who we know from his great career in the Quatermass Experiment. He was the guy who gets turned into the monster in that Quatermass Experiment, also known as the Creeping Unknown, in 1955. And Richard Wordsworth in this one plays a totally different role. He's still as gaunt as he was in the Quatermass Experiment. But his beggar goes through an incredible character arc in a short space of this film. We see him as a kind of filthy beggar. He kind of dances for the amusement of the gentry who were assembled for the Marquise's wedding. He's a pathetic and sad figure who accidentally offends the Marquise, who just locks him in a dungeon and leaves him there for 15 years. And we see him first being fed by the servant girl, who never actually gets a name, which is a shame, because she's mute. She can't tell people what her name is, played by Yvonne Romain. But we see her as a young girl feeding the beggar, who again doesn't have a name either. And as she grows older, she still keeps feeding him even after her father dies. There's a bit of a narration by the Clifford Evans character that covers through some of this stuff. Then as time passes, we see the beggar become more and more bestial. He has hair covering his arms. It's almost like the werewolfism, the lycanthropy, is a function of extreme deprivation and poverty. He becomes an animal because of the way he's treated by rich people. Now, that's a thing we can all kind of make parallels to, of course. But Richard Wordsworth does play it very, very well. And I think that the rape, when it occurs, when the servant girl is thrown into the dungeon with the beggar, is handled very well. It's handled very discreetly. It's handled with appropriate horror. And the weird thing is we understand the character of the person performing the rape more than we do in a lot of movies. This man's been driven insane and to bestial urges, in a sense, by the abuse he's been dealt with. And that's a kind of theme that resonates a lot because, you know, a lot of people who perpetrate crimes of sex, whether it's child abuse or rape or things like that, in a lot of instances you find that they were abused themselves in a number of ways. And this is what happens with this character. And that kind of makes the movie horrible. It's a different kind of horror than the horror we get with a werewolf. It's a horror of abuse, and it's a horror of privilege, and it's a horror of class warfare. And this movie's got that in there. And I went, what? Because I hadn't seen the movie for 25 years. And when I watched it this time, I went, yeah, they've kept something that's true to Guy Endor's work here, in the fact that he was a campaigner for egalitarianism. And right at the start of Curse of the Werewolf, they show us what privilege and inequality can do to people that are victimized by them. We do get to come up into the Marquis, who is played by Anthony Dawson, who played Strangways in the first James Bond film, Dr. No, around a year after he did this film. And we see him over a 15-year period as well, and he goes from being a kind of vital and middle-aged man to a decrepit, pustuled, lecherous old mongrel. And so, you know, there's kind of character arcs for three characters in this, the beggar, the servant girl, and the Marquis. We see them all over that 15-year period of time change. Now, the young boy, Leon, grows up to be Oliver Reed, of course. And Oliver Reed's very good in this film. He does the kind of bestial stuff quite well, because Oliver Reed, as we know, was a man who had his demon. But we also see him do the comedy and the romantic stuff and the kind of softer character stuff when he's talking with Clifford Evans' character who raised him, and the servant lady who raised him. Oliver Reed kind of does do that range, and he plays the romantic lead quite well as well. He was a gifted actor. He was charismatic. He could play the arc of the character very well. And as we all know, unfortunate addiction to alcohol let him piss his talents away over the years. But if you have a look at this movie and things like The Damned as well, the Joseph Losey movie, The Damned, you see Oliver Reed at the height of his powers, and he's really an English actor that, who had circumstances been different, would have got a lot more respect. He would have had a knighthood. He would have been, you know, doing guest spots in Doctor Who and who knows what else. He really, he died slightly early because of the alcoholism, of course. He died on the location when they were making Gladiator, Ridley Scott's Gladiator, and a lot of his scenes had to be CG'd at the end of it to put him in and close off the arc of his character in that movie. But Oliver Reed I like because he was a kind of, in a sense, a reaction against the, not only the kind of gentrified English actors we saw in the 1950s, your Dirk Bogarts and your Stuart Grangers and things like that, but he didn't quite fit either into the angry young men, people like Albert Finney and Tom Courtney and Richard Burton. He was kind of, he could play posh, but he could play working class as well. He didn't really fit into a narrow niche as an actor. And in this movie, even though it was, in a sense, slumming for him at the start of his career, but we see the kind of charisma that he brought to later roles. And he is quite interesting in this film, and he lets full vent the emotions when he's playing the werewolf as well. Now, props have got to also be given to Les Bowie's werewolf makeup, which he admitted was influenced by the Henry Hole makeup in Werewolf to London. But I think he's taken it a lot further, because Henry Hole was a kind of small and skinny guy. The werewolf makeup sat differently on him than Les Bowie's werewolf makeup sits on Oliver Reed, who was much more burly. His werewolf is appropriately grey, because a lot of wolves are grey. And the ears are higher up the head and pointed. Those kind of bulging brow ridges make things much more interesting, and the glaring eyes. There's a scene at the start where we see the werewolf, and you can see the contact lenses Oliver Reed wore. But nonetheless, Oliver Reed's got a kind of burly and muscular werewolf, and we see him climbing around the Bray Studios sets that are a village with the villagers with torches following him around and tracking him down. And the interesting thing from my point of view is, yes, ultimately, of course, I've got to kill him with a silver bullet. But the interesting thing for me is the fact that he is tracked very much as an animal is tracked. If a wild, say, wolf went into a village, the way they track Leon is very consistent with that. It's done very well from that point of view. Now, one of the other things that I should mention, and I love that scene where one of the villagers throws a torch up into a bale of hay that's up in one of the lofts, and Leon's hiding behind it. Leon just picks up the burning bale of hay and throws it down at the villagers. I love that little bit of improvised stuff there. But one of the other things I like about the film is there's some interesting character actors in it. We've got Michael Ripper, who was a perennial with Hammer horror films, playing an old kind of alcoholic guy who sees some things he can't quite understand and ends up in the same jail cell as Leon, which is not a good thing to happen when somebody's turning into a werewolf. We've also got a character actor who ultimately became an Australian and retired and died here, and that is Warren Mitchell, a fantastic English character actor who people might know from Till Death Us Do Part, but he had a long career playing all sorts of different characters. In this one, he's playing a kind of gameskeeper character whose job in the town is to keep wolves away from people's livestock. And even though he does do it with a little bit of a Zomers accent, he's kind of interesting too. I love Warren Mitchell in anything I see him in. He's really kind of a valuable player in this kind of thing. He didn't do a lot of Hammer horror films, but he did do a lot of kind of character roles in various films before his television success, playing the character on whom Archie Bunker was based in Johnny Spates' Till Death Us Do Part later in the 1960s. That kind of reactionary, racist, old fart character is something that Warren Mitchell originated, playing a character about 20 or 30 years older than he actually was. But nonetheless, it was interesting seeing him in there as well. Yvonne Romain, who plays the raped chambermaid, or servant girl, is known for one other thing more than anything, and that is the fact that in the movie that Anthony Perkins and Steven Spielberg wrote, The Last of Sheila, which had Diane Cannon and James Coburn in it, she played Sheila, who never gets to be seen but is only seen in photographs, but that was Yvonne Romain. That's a werewolf movie. This one's interesting for the fact that the werewolf is a sympathetic character, but we actually see what happens before the birth of the werewolf and how the lycanthropy in this film seems to be based on the nasty things done to a person by rich people. Now, in the original book, Werewolf of Paris, they had something which they could never have had, a movie in 1961. The rape that occurs by the servant girl whose parents, the Leon character in the book, she's actually raped by a priest. And you couldn't put that in a movie at that time because the rape people being raped by priests wasn't something you're allowed to talk about, even in real life. And of course, we all know the consequences of that. But in movies, you definitely weren't able to go there. So they had to make it a beggar. But nonetheless, they did manage to squeeze through, in Anthony Hines' very good script, that knowledge that in some way the wealth and privileged people are responsible for what occurred. And of course, this has got that beautiful technicolor look that a lot of Hammer horror films had. They always had that beautiful saturated colour with the Kensington gore blood, which looks nothing at all like real blood, but nonetheless does the job very well. It's even though, again, there were budgetary restrictions, as indeed there were with all Hammer films, I think they tell the story really well. And having Ollie Reed was a brilliant piece of casting. I'm not sure of I can think of another actor who could have done it as well. Would have been interesting to see someone like Stanley Baker do it. But nonetheless, even though he was a little bit older than Oliver Reed was, I kind of liked the idea that Stanley Baker and Oliver Reed were very similar kinds of actors. They were kind of at a time when English actors were very kind of gentrified and polite and things like that. There were two actors who really had that kind of earthy muscularity about them, and one of them was Stanley Baker and the other one was Oliver Reed. But just to finalise it, I like Curse of the Werewolf. It has some very disturbing bits in it, but the disturbing bits aren't necessarily those that people in 1961 found disturbing. And also, there's a nice little bit by the kid playing young Leon, where he talks about hunting with squirrels with the Warren Mitchell character. So look out for that bit when you see the film, because that's a really interesting little piece of character work there. If the kid's deadpan lack of effect as an actor really kind of makes this fantastically good piece of narrative. But anyway, I'm going to finish it up there, and I'm going to finish the podcast as well. I'm not sure whether the next Martian Drive-In is going to be the live one that I record a continuum with Grant and Narelle, It may be the next one, it may be the one after that. I just haven't got my dates right yet. But nonetheless, that is upcoming, and please wait out for that. Thank you for listening, and thank you to the Patreon subscribers as well. And thank you to everybody who goes on Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and talks about things. I want to generate more than that, more of that. So if you're listening and you want to throw a few comments there or ask a question or throw something out to the listeners or to the people who, not listeners, but, you know, well, I suppose listeners, but the people who interact on the Paleo Cinema Cafe, just do it. It's an open church. Even though I'm the administrator on it, I'm more than happy for people to start discussions on it. I haven't updated the credits yet, but I will do in the next week or two. One of the things that's kind of kept me from doing that is this week where I had to take Sal to hospital. She had a major anxiety attack. We thought might have been some kind of a cardiac thing, but it turns out it wasn't. And so that kind of put a dent in the middle of the week when I was going to get a lot of this admin stuff done. And I apologize for that nonetheless. But take care of yourselves. Look after yourselves. Watch good movies. Watch bad movies. Watch lots of movies. And make sure that you keep your liquids up. I'll be back next week with a Paleo Cinema podcast. In 2 weeks with a Martian Driving podcast. In the meantime, enjoy yourselves. And as usual, I'm going to throw another song at the end of the podcast after the credits. And this time it's going to be another one by Miss Toni Fisher, Why Won't the Dark Leave Me Alone, which is kind of appropriate for work. And now here are the podcast credits. I'd like to thank Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, our Technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tamora, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Solomon, our werewolf consultant, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H., our set photographer, and the two extras, Mark D. and David L. Thank you to all of the podcast supporters.
Strange how the dark makes you remember strange little things out of the past. Things like a chance, casual glance, things like a joke, or like the times we'd smoke that last cigarette. Why must the dark make me remember all of those things I should forget? Why must I wake from my sleep craving a love that is gone? Why can't the dark leave me alone? Why must the dark bring you close to me? Why must the dark light the way? Eyes to me, back to the times when you whispered sighs to me. Oh, why must the dark make me remember all of those things I should forget? Why must I wake from my sleep